This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Regular guest financial planner Kevin McKinley is on vacation this week, but we are very happy to have with us our sometimes fill-in guest expert, nationally renowned personal finance writer Jane Bryant Quinn. We are going to talk about the turbulent June that we had in the financial markets and what the near and long-term future holds for your investments. Plus, we'll have advice on a wide variety of personal finance matters, and we welcome your questions. How concerned are you about your investments given the market's shaky history lately? What questions do you have about navigating the uncertainty? Do you have any personal finance questions about saving for retirement or saving for a major purchase or maybe caring for a loved one with special needs? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Jane Bryant Quinn is a personal finance writer and co-founder of DailyVoice.com, an online community news organization in New York, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. She is author of Making the Most of Your Money Now. She also writes the monthly Financially Speaking column for the AARP Bulletin and a column for DimeSpring.com. Her website is JaneBryantQuinn.com, and she joins us by telephone. Hello, thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Joy. Always nice to talk to you.
It's great to have you back. You know, I was on vacation myself the past couple of weeks, and I had actually seen my financial advisor just prior to that. And then the stock market went on this roller coaster, and we saw some days with big losses, and it was kind of scary. What can you explain what happened there?
First, were you watching it every day, Joy?
No, I was not.
Thank you very much. That was the right thing to do. Everyone is, of course, concerned about, we've had a big run-up in stocks until this month. We got a really good run this year. We've had a good run in bonds. And now the question is, what's happening with the economy and the Federal Reserve, which has been using its monetary policy to help keep the economy going. There were some questions that maybe they would reverse what they've been doing or slow down what they've been doing, and everybody immediately got scared. Now, I don't know if individuals got scared. When I say everybody, you have to remember that most of the money in the stock market is now, and the bond market too, is professionally managed money, and they tend to run around a whole lot more often than individuals do.
Now, part of this was caused by the Fed Chair Ben Bernanke's comments about eventually ending quantitative easing. That was that got some in the market kind of nervous.
That's right, and whether it would be what they call tapering off, slowing down the amount that they have been, you know. I hate to use phrases like quantitative easing because it's sort of complicated, but basically they've been using their monetary policy to keep short-term interest rates down and to help keep the economy moving along in view of the fact that on the fiscal side, on the spending, government spending side, both state and federal, everything's getting tighter, the deficit is going down, so there's not a lot of, you know, so it's very tight on the fiscal side, and so the Federal Reserve has been supporting the economy by basically having easy money, and that's been very effective in keeping the economy going so far. Now, if they pull back from this quantitative easing, the concern is that interest rates will go up, and of course they have gone up a little bit, bond rates will go down, and is this a concern for the economy? And frankly, Joy, I am not concerned, but this was the worry. And after all, bonds have been on this big run. Interest rates are unusually low, held down by short rates held down by the Federal Reserve and longer-term rates held down by the fact that the economy is just coming along very slowly. And sooner or later, you know, these are going to reverse. Interest rates will go up a little. And so people just started to get worried about what that might mean.
Yeah, and I don't like to use words like quantitative easing either. Essentially, that, as you put it, that's monetary policy. Others say it's stimulus. It's that the Fed was putting money in there to.
It's good. Yes, it's stimulus. Basically, they've been. I mean, if all there was, if the Fed was doing its usual thing, and the money was being cut so rapidly from federal spending and from state spending, we'd be in a recession again. So the Federal Reserve has basically been the money, the stimulus that has been gone in from the monetary policy has been extremely helpful in keeping the economy from dipping back down while government spending was being cut.
And now you're not concerned about necessarily the economy taking a dive or anything like that. Why would the markets have such a negative reaction to this stimulus coming to a close?
First, they don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Second, the fact that interest rates have been kept deliberately, short-term interest rates kept deliberately low. The idea of interest rates going up, maybe that will do something bad to the economy, and they're worried about that. And they just don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, you get a period of sudden uncertainty. No one was expecting Bernanke to say anything like that, and he did. The president has indicated that this is probably Bernanke's last term. That's a sense of, concern. Mm-hmm. And you just have to remember that the market is full of hot money. I can't emphasize enough that most of these quick turns that you see in the market, they're not only professionally managed. A great deal of it is all run by computer. You know, there are decisions made in milliseconds. So there's really not a lot of slack for people sitting back and thinking, I wonder if it has this meaning or if it has that meaning. Everyone reacts instantly, and people like you and me just have to say, okay, well, you know, what is our position? How is our, you know, what are we looking at long term? And just ignore these crazy moments because we can't fight computers that are making trades in milliseconds.
Right, and I don't watch the market on an hour by hour basis or even a day by day basis, but it was really a coincidence that we had seen our financial advisor shortly before this happened, in part because my husband's approaching retirement age, and we were kind of talking about how, wow, it's great that his retirement fund had kind of recovered from the financial crisis, and then that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, just a little nerve-wracking. But did that roller coaster at the end of June put much pain on people's investments?
It was so fast, and mm-hmm. we've had so many quick turns like that, that certainly mm-hmm. on the bond side, I mean, if you were invested in certain high-yield municipals or you were invested in emerging market bonds, you might have lost 7%, or maybe emerging market bonds could be even 10%. But if you were invested in the Vanguard sort of intermediate term bond fund, the loss for this whole year, for the year as a whole since January, is 0.79%, as I looked mm-hmm. up this morning. So that's not a really serious loss. The total bond index for Vanguard over 1 year, the loss is 0.85%. So it's a question of how you were invested. You know, the headlines said, oh, what are you going to do? Interest rates went up, bond rates went down. But, you know, the average person is not exclusively invested in emerging market bonds. And so if they're doing the sensible thing and being in index funds that have a whole range of diversified bonds, they probably didn't lose a lot. And if you look at what bonds have done over 5 years of these index diversified funds, you've got gains of 5 or 6% a year. So you've done pretty well. And, you know, Joy, interest rates have been historically low and things do revert to a mean. So there's going to be a time when interest rates go up a little and bond values go down a little. That's how it goes. And everybody invested in bonds know that kind of thing is going to happen at some point.
Well, no, you wrote a piece for AARP about how middle-aged people should approach the transition from aggressive to more conservative investments, and that's something that strikes near and dear to me. What's the first step there?
Well, you know, one thing is that you should not go entirely to fixed income investments, and a lot of people have done that just because they've been so afraid of the stock market ever since, 08, 09, and look at what they've lost by not having been in the market. When you sell quickly when stocks are really bad, it, by the time you can make up your mind to go back in, you know, stocks tend to be back up again. So, you know, that's why I'm someone who is more on the buy and hold side, except at remarkable turns. You should be buying and holding. Now, this could be a remarkable turn for interest rates, and so that raises a big question for especially people like you and your husband, you know, when you're looking forward to retirement and what should the balance between stocks and bonds be. So generally, you know, the rule of thumb has always been that your age should equal the percentage of stocks that you have, and so that still leaves you, you know, substantially in stocks when you're 50, 55, 60. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I think that's a pretty good idea. If you are depending totally on your stocks to produce your retirement income, then it's not a good idea. But most likely you've got Social Security, you may have a pension, you have some savings, you have some money in bonds, or you have money in cash. And so you've got a cushion for that. But when you're just pre-retirement age and, you know, just entering into retirement, you know, you've got another 20, 30 years ahead of you. And you just can't say, I'm going to make it on interest rates alone unless you're willing to live really low. And that's a question you have to put to yourself. It is one of the options. I'm only going to be in fixed income. I'm only going to live on my dividends and interest. And I will cut my spending as low as it has to be in order to do that. So there are some people who advise that you do that, and that becomes a lifestyle choice.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Jane Bryant Quinn. She is a personal finance expert and writer. She is author of Making the Most of Your Money Now. She also writes the monthly Financially Speaking column for AARP, the AARP Bulletin. She is filling in for Kevin McKinley today, and we welcome your personal finance questions, whatever they may be, at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine talking on this edition of On Your Money with Jane Bryant Quinn, welcoming your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Do you have a money matter on your mind today? How concerned are you about your investments given the market's shaky history lately? Do you have any questions about how your investments should be as you perhaps start your career or approach retirement? Are you saving for a major purchase? We'll talk a little bit about the housing market, on quite the rebound as well during this edition of On Your Money. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. A listener in Iola called in to ask why loans are expensive when interest for savings is so low. He says he earns 36 cents a month on a savings account that has thousands of dollars in it. What's up with that?
Well, what's up with the savings account is what we've been talking about, Joy, and that is short-term interest rates. The Federal Reserve has been keeping short-term interest rates unusually low in order to help spur the economy because government spending is slowing down so sharply that you have to have something to keep the economy going, and they're keeping interest rates low. And this is hitting people with savings accounts. It's hitting people in short-term bonds. It's hitting all of those short-term investments, and it's tough, and it's probably going to stay that way for a while. Now, obviously, the loans are another matter that has to do with the fact that most of these loans are longer term, and also they are more expensive to run than savings accounts, and they can get away with it. So you put all those things together, and loans are going to be more expensive, especially, talking about 13% or 15% or more. We're talking about credit card consumer loans. Mortgage loans, as you know, are extremely cheap.
Right.
So it's the revolving loans, the consumer loans, the loans where there are higher default rates, loans that are more expensive to administer, they are running at higher rates.
Well, I did just see a piece about the fact that maybe mortgage interest rates were going to be on their way up after being so very low for so long, and that might cause a run on the housing market, that people will want to try to jump in and get that house now before mortgage rates go up. How do you see the housing market going?
I think the housing market is very promising. And this is one of the way the housing market is going is one of the reasons that I continue to be optimistic about the economy and therefore optimistic about the stock market, which is always a dangerous thing to say. But the because rates have been so low, you're right, when there's rates go up a little, and they have gone up a little, people say, gee, I better lock it in now. But also, consumers are spending a little bit more. The numbers of jobs are increasing. They've been increasing steadily, not a lot, but they've been increasing. And so that means a little more money, consumer money in the economy. Housing prices have been extremely reasonable, and now you can see housing prices are going up. Probably that, even more than the interest rate thing, would be driving people to look to see if they could buy a house. And the home ownership and the improvement in people buying homes usually precedes a stronger and more rapidly growing economy. And so as long as the home purchase sector of the economy seems to have turned around and keeps on moving up, I'm going to be pretty optimistic about, the year, 2 years, whatever ahead.
Let's take some calls. Patty in Eau Claire joins us first. Hello, Patty.
Yes, good morning. With all due respect, I believe you are talking about and invested in, no pun intended, a system that's obsolete. I don't believe that there is a slow recovery. I personally believe there's a slow collapse. And I'm 57, and many people in my group and younger are not looking at the market to save for a retirement that's going to give us all a happy ending. To me, my money is going in buying into an intentional community, living communally with sustainable farming, working in healthcare with medicinal things like herbal remedies and things like that, way out of the box. And I do believe that it's all changing. Our economy is so tied into the globe, and the focus on individual competition and the traditional ways of looking at it, I really think is dead and gone, and things have to be done more cooperatively and communally and with the focus on earth-centered sustainability in mind. And that's not happening from mainstream government or the mainstream market.
Thank you very much, Patty. What's your reaction to that, Jane?
Actually, I am much more closely plugged into that than I'll bet Patty guesses, because my stepdaughter is living exactly the life that she is, that Patty is talking about. She and her husband have a farm. They have chickens. I have to save my garbage scraps because that's what she feeds the chickens. They've just gotten some goats. She publishes actually a wonderful little newsletter. It's local for the upstate New York area where she lives, called Dirt, which is all about sustainable living and sustainable farming. She doesn't buy new clothes. She and her friends exchange clothes. So I am very much aware of the way of living that Patty is talking about, and I think it's a worthwhile thing to buy into. It is a choice of lifestyle, and there are other people who, you know, have 401ks and have different plans for their futures. But my stepdaughter, who is 32 and has a new baby, and her husband are doing exactly what Patty is talking about.
Yeah, thanks, Patty, for the call. And, boy, I think that we may have spoken to your stepdaughter at least one of the programs on Wisconsin Public Radio. It certainly sounds familiar. Dirt is the name of her blog, did you say?
It's the name of her publication,
yeah.
Dirt. She doesn't have a blog about it. I'm involved in online community news, so my husband and I are very much into news online. She is saying, nope, news on paper. So
yeah.
She's very old-fashioned in many ways.
Let's go next to Chris in Oshkosh. Hello, Chris.
Yeah, good morning. I guess my question for your guest and you are just regarding 401k. I recently started one about a year ago, and my company does match the, a 50% match on my 6%. So I guess I put in the 6%, but I guess I look at it as essentially it's like I'm making 50% at all times. And I guess you kind of maybe tell me if that's true, but yet I guess one of my big questions is, you know, I saw, obviously, in 2008 when all these things were happening, and I guess I had some personal investments that I was doing myself early on before I actually got involved with the 401k, and I pulled my stuff out because I just saw I was losing a lot of money. And I guess at this point, I see that I'm, no matter what, I'm going to be gaining 50% is the way I look at it. But if, let's say, something tragic happens, you know, we get some kind of natural disaster, or we have, you know, terrorism, something in my lifetime here in the next, you know, 40 years, something comes up, am I going to ever, I guess, what do I do with my 401k if all of a sudden I see that something, you know, people are going to sell off, things are going to get, you know, a little strange? What's the proper procedure, I guess? What are your suggestions on when I see something happening? What do I do?
First, Chris, how old are you?
I'm 32.
32. Well, my first thing is that this economy is going to go on for you, say, let's say another 70 years, just to be roughly roundabout. I know Patty thinks it may collapse before that, but I don't. So you have a long time. There have been so many disasters in our economy. If you look back in the global economy over the past 70 years, and yet, where are we? We are much, on average, not for many people, and I do know that, but I'm saying on average, countries are wealthier, you know, stocks are up, standards of living are higher if you look back 70 years ago. So that is what is going to happen. At 32, you should be putting more than 6% into your 401k. It is fabulous that your company is matching, and, you know, that's free money. That's you should absolutely be up to that, but you should be putting in more. A lot of companies aren't matching anymore, so that's why you are so fortunate to have a company that is doing that. And you should be putting, at your age, you should be putting the maximum in, and you should be very heavily tipped toward stock, you know, well-diversified stock-owning mutual funds, like an index fund. There's probably a stock index fund in your 401k. And if you think that something terrible is going to happen, look back at the other times when something as terrible has happened, like 08, and here we are. Stocks are basically back to where they were. Think about World War II. I mean, that was something really terrible that happened, and yet stocks are up hugely since World War II. If the globe blows up or collapses, as Patty is concerned about, believe you me, the 401k is the last problem you're going to have to worry about. I think the main thing you should think about is not getting scared when the market goes down, because if you just pull up on your screen the history of the market, you'll see lots of times the market goes down and then the market comes back up. And you have a lot of years to wait. And these are the years for you to be putting in that money and to be heavily invested in stocks. And sometimes the market goes down 50%. And that's when you sort of panic and say, ah, I shouldn't be here. But please, you know, go online, look up the history of the stock market and say to yourself, over the next 70 years that I've got, what's going to happen to this? It's going to come back. And if I get out now because I'm scared, sure as heck, I will be too scared to get back in until the market is basically back where it was when I sold, and I will have lost the opportunity to make up money that I lost. So I just don't think you should be thinking about how I get out in case of disasters, because I believe in the American economy, and I believe the American economy is going to be here a long time. And when you're invested in, say, an index stock index fund broadly invested across the American economy, or a total index fund invested across the world, you are going to be okay.
Thanks, Chris, and good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Jane Bryant Quinn, personal finance writer, author of Making the Most of Your Money Now. She also writes the monthly Financially Speaking column for the AARP Bulletin, among many other credentials. If you have a question for her, personal finance question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our regular financial planner, Kevin McKinley, is on vacation this week. He will be back next week. Well, you know, I know, Jane Bryant Quinn, that you wrote about Roth IRAs recently. How do we know if a Roth IRA is right for us, and why are Roth IRAs looking more and more attractive today?
Roth IRA is a tax-favored retirement account, and when you put money into a Roth IRA, there is no tax deduction up front. With a regular IRA, you put money in, you get a tax deduction for your contribution, and then later when you're retired and you take money out, then you pay taxes as you take the money out. The Roth, it is not a tax-free contribution, but when you take the money out in retirement, all the money comes out tax-free. I think that is a fabulous deal, especially for younger people, but I think it's a fabulous deal for, you know, practically anybody, because having the option of tax-free money in retirement is going to be something where everybody will be very happy to have. The other thing is that unlike regular IRAs, with a Roth IRA, you have access to your money. Because if I put $1,000 into a Roth IRA today, and next week I suddenly need the money, I can take that $1,000 back out. No taxes, no penalties. I can't take out any earnings on the money without paying a penalty. But you can always take out at any time without penalty, without taxes, the amount of money that you contributed for yourself. So that if you are, you know, say a younger person or a middle-aged person, and you're saying, well, I might need this money and I might not, if you invested in a Roth IRA and, you know, buy mutual funds with your investments, you have this wonderful flexibility where if you don't need the money, you know, you keep it for the long term, and when you take it out in retirement, there are no taxes. And if you do need the money, you can take out as much as you contributed with no tax and no penalty. I think it's a sweet deal.
Let's take another call, this time from Mark in Oshkosh. Hello, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, with computer trades occurring within milliseconds, does that have an impact on the return on my 401k or my IRA accounts?
what they say is that it makes the whole market more liquid with all these computers kicking around and making such rapid turns. It does not probably, in most cases, harm any individual investors, because if you are in a mutual fund, most likely your mutual fund is participating in all of this. Part of index funds are run by computers, although it's not necessarily, they call it high frequency trading, the sort of millisecond thing. This is something that is just done through the market. It is not taking money out of your IRA or your 401k. But one of the reasons why I like so much being invested in index funds in the market as a whole is that you are up against this kind of thing. You really can't outthink a computer if you're trying to day trade yourself or to buy individual stocks. These high frequency trading, however, I don't think that it's good for the economy as a whole, because, you know, all this money is just being traded back and forth between investment bankers, and it's making money for them, and it's not going into the economy as a whole. You know, it's not like they were actually manufacturing something useful. They're just running money back and forth between themselves. But for you and for me and for individuals, this is not harming our returns.
Thank you very much, Mark. We are talking with Jane Bryant Quinn during this edition of On Your Money, and we welcome your personal finance questions for her at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking on this edition of On Your Money with financial expert, personal finance expert, Jane Bryant Quinn, who is helping us out today while personal finance expert Kevin McKinley is on vacation. And we thank her for that. It's always nice when she can be with us from time to time. Well, we have an email from Andy. Andy emails, I'm a student moving into my last year of school. Could you talk a bit about how the increase in federal loan rates are likely to affect students and the economy at large in the short and the long term? Also, do we have any options to get out of what I see as a very burdensome loan?
The Congress and its gridlocked state, which is so enraging to so many people, failed to prevent the interest rate on student loans going up July 1st. It's going up to 6.8% from 3.4%, which is very alarming to students, and I don't blame Andy for being alarmed about it. At the moment, the expectation is that eventually they will pass a bill retroactively saying that if the interest rate is not going to double, and to make some different arrangement for interest rates, probably that attaches it to some short-term loan rate, so it is a floating rate with a cap somewhere. So I think most likely you're not going to wind up paying double interest rates as a result this year. But you never can tell. This is Congress. I think they figured out that over the average term of the average loan, that would probably work out to an additional $1,000. Now, it sounds as if Andy doesn't have the average loan. He's got a much larger loan. And if that is burdensome, as it is for so many students, your best thing to do is to look immediately into how to restructure, how to refinance that loan so that perhaps you pay over longer period. Perhaps you can get, if it's a direct loan, you can get something, loan payments that are linked to the amount of your income. Income-based payments, which can be very low if you have a low income. So there are many ways of trying to restructure a large loan to bring the payments into something more realistically, and you should know, you'll find plenty of information of that on the government website, the ed.gov for the education department. So you should look it up and see what your options are. Now, these are with federal loans. With private loans from banks, the options are not so great, but you can see what you can do there. One thing that is just essential is that you keep paying these loans. Andy has hit one of the things where I rant, the subjects that I love to rant about. What is so enraging is that the private loans in particular, but also public loans, you know, these can't be discharged in bankruptcy. It doesn't matter what kind of trouble you get into later in life. You lose your job, you have a disability, you have various kinds of problems. These loans can't be discharged in bankruptcy in almost all cases. And this means that when you've got these huge loans that become unpayable, and if you miss some payments, you can't believe what the costs are. This is why I urge you to try to get them restructured and so that you have payments you can do. There are people who are paying off their student loans or who are being chased by bill collectors in their 60s. Because the loan that started out as a $10,000 loan is now a $150,000 loan because they haven't been able to pay it. I mean, you can be tortured for life. There are some loans now that if you can't pay after 25, again, federal loans, if you can't pay after 25 years or if you've made payments and you're still in trouble, they can be forgiven. But again, look all that up on ED.gov. But the private loans, man, they will chase you and chase you and chase you forever. And one of the reasons that banks are so willing to give out private loans, whether students have even to students who already have too much money borrowed, is that they know they're backed by the government. You can't get out of them from bankruptcy. So the banks are perfectly able to be careless about these loans and just pump them out to you, because they know they're protected, but you, the student, are not protected. And they put in that rule in Congress in maybe 2006, 2007. They protected the banks, saying that private borrowers from private banks couldn't discharge the loans in bankruptcy either. First, I think that was a terrible thing to do to students. It was great for banks. And I would love to see that reversed, but it's not going to be reversed anytime soon. You've got to figure out how to pay those loans and keep them going, because believe me, they will torture you for life.
That was a good rant, and that was rant-worthy. Yeah, I'm just kidding.
It's one of the things, and you can see here, you know, these student debts are piling up and piling up and piling up. And you know, the bankers, the private bankers, no problem. I got a backstop. They can't get out of it. You know, borrow more. I do think now that more parents and students are thinking ahead of time. Yes, I was accepted by a school that is a great school, but I'm going to have to take a big student loan. Maybe I ought to go to a school that doesn't have such a huge reputation, but I'm not going to have to borrow as much money. That, I mean, I beg students to be thinking that way, because the student loan debt is just getting to be frightening, and it hangs over you all your life if you don't happen to get a really high-paying job that can pay it off.
Our next caller is Michelle in Arkansas, Wisconsin. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you?
Very good.
Good. I'm thoroughly petrified.
Oh.
Yeah. My question is regarding student loans. Actually, my husband and I have student loan debt and also credit card debt. And going along with another caller, also we have the opportunity to put money into a 401k that's 50% matched. So at this point, we're kind of wondering what is the best decision, because we do you know, have the ability to put money towards that debt, of course, or put it into the 401k. So I wondered what your thoughts would be on that.
You could restructure your student loan debt for lower payments. We talked about that. Of course, if you have lower payments, it means it's going to stretch out over a longer period of time, which means you pay more interest in the long run. You know, there's no free lunch there. But I would say that you should first try to do something with your 401k, because that is, if it's just taken out of your paycheck, you don't see it. and therefore you don't spend it, and you will adjust the rest of your life to the amount of money you see in the bank. I would do the 401k up to whatever the match is. Then whatever you've got left, you're going to have to cut back on your spending somewhere. And the thing is that if the money is taken out of your paycheck automatically, so you don't even see it, you will find ways to cut spending that you can't even imagine now, because you will, as usual, spend everything that's in your paycheck, that's in the bank account, but you're going to have less there, so you will figure out ways to spend less. It's the only magic in personal finance. You spend what's in your checking account, and if money is taken out automatically for savings and doesn't go into your checking account, you still spend what's in your checking account, but you're spending less and you don't even know how you did it. So do the 401k, minimize your student loan debt, and hit that credit card debt, and it suggests to me you might have a spending problem, and that's what I think you and your husband have to sit down and look about. Where is our spending problem? And if you have the money going into the 401k, that makes it really easy to confront your spending problem because you won't have as much money in your checking account.
Yeah, good luck to you, Michelle. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money, talking this week with Jane Bryant Quinn, and our next caller is Tom in Madison. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Joy. Quick question. Is there any sense to someone of moderate to middle means to using life insurance as an investment vehicle?
No, I am not in favor of life insurance as an investment vehicle because the expense part of it is simply very high, and what you get in terms of the investments compared with other options is going to be much lower. Now, if you have a need, because this would be a permanent life policy, what they call a cash value policy. If you have some kind of need for life insurance that lasts for life, for example, if you have a disabled child or something like that, where you have to have life insurance even into a later age to make sure that you leave some money for this child, then you should have this cash value life insurance. It does have an investment component, but you're not even thinking about that. Assuming you just need life insurance because you have someone to take care of if you die, which is the only reason to have life insurance, you should have cheap term insurance, and your person of moderate means, you should start thinking about putting money into a low-cost index mutual fund, like the kind they have at Vanguard, for example, and let it grow. How old are you, Tom?
Oh, I'm sorry, Tom, dropped off.
Oh, okay. But at any rate, it is not the whole idea that a life insurance is a great investment possibility just for investment. I just don't buy that and never have.
Speaking of insurance, not life insurance, but long-term health care insurance, what's your take on that?
I am a believer in long-term health care insurance, and again, I had an experience with that because my late husband, who for a while they were terrible policies and they were hardly worth having, and then when they started being worth having, unfortunately, my husband had an illness and couldn't qualify for them. And so during his last illness, taking care of him was extraordinarily expensive, as I'm sure you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And so I am strongly in favor of having long-term care insurance if you have the sort of income where you can afford the premiums. The premiums are very expensive and they are going up. And so you have to have substantial assets and a substantial income to be able to afford long-term care insurance. But if you have that, I think it makes tremendous amount of sense. In my husband's last year, it cost $100,000 to have him properly taken care of at home, you know, that's a lot of money out of savings. So, but I was able to afford it, but it just shows you, you know, in that sort of a bracket where you can't afford it, but man, it costs a lot. That's where you need long-term care insurance. In fact, I'm very happy to say I'm now remarried, but the man I married, the deal was I'm marrying you after you buy long-term care insurance. Don't want to do that twice. Yeah. However, people of moderate means, and I'm thinking of Tom who just called, first, long-term care insurance, the premiums are just out of sight. They're just not for you. But when you have moderate means, that is where the Medicaid program comes in, because if you have sort of a certain amount of money, you can get into a nursing home and maybe you can pay for 6 months or 8 months or a year or something like that. After that, Medicaid will take over and they will pay your nursing home bills. And that is what the majority of people of moderate means depend on. It's one of the reasons why people are so concerned about future spending on Medicaid. Everybody thinks of, oh, it's just a program for the poor, and you know, there's a lot of sense that maybe the poor shouldn't have it, at least in some quarters. But it also is the major financing for older people of moderate means who need either care at home, depending on your state, or care in a nursing home. And that's going to be a huge problem going forward if Medicaid is funded less.
I also promised that I would ask you about a piece you wrote about how a lot of grandparents are helping their grandkids with the costs of higher education because parents are having trouble making ends meet. What do grandparents need to know before simply writing out a check?
The first thing they need to know is that they should not disturb their own retirement in order to do that. Because you know, younger people, if they borrow, they have to borrow. Their parents didn't save. I'm really sorry for the younger people, but you know, older people, you know, that's all the money you have for the rest of your life, and you don't want to impoverish yourself, even for the grandchildren that you love madly. So one thing is that help them if you can, but write only the check that you can afford, and don't give a promise saying I will write this check every year, because things might change and you know you get sick, you have health expenses, you might not be able to write that check every year. You can start, if you want to, a very good way to help younger grandchildren looking forward to college is to start a 529 plan for them. These 529 tax deferred plans are all states but Wyoming have them, and they're just terrific plans for saving money for college. And you probably will get a state tax break for starting a 529 plan for your grandchild or your child, for that matter, if we're talking children. SavingForCollege.com is a good site to go on to. It will direct you to your own state sites and show you how you can invest directly in a 529 plan for college. And again, you can, you know, put in $1,000 this year and then nothing next year and then $5,000 the year after if you happen to have it. So there's a lot of flexibility in that.
Thank you, Jane Bryant-Quinn, so much for being with us again.
I always like talking to you, Joy.
Thank you
to your audience.
Yes, thanks very much. Jane Bryant-Quinn is the author of Making the Most of Your Money Now. She also writes the monthly Financially Speaking column for the AARP Bulletin. She was filling in today for Kevin McKinley. He will be back next week for another edition of On Your Money. Stay with us. Tomorrow we are going to talk about clash, 8 cultural conflicts that make us who we are. That's tomorrow, Wednesday, between 8 and 9. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.